When I was a child growing up, there were three of us in the family, my brother older than I'm in the middle, my younger sister. And my mother said he didn't relate to us much when we were babies, but as soon as we got language, he began to enjoy us more. And I remember being in the car with him and discovering that he had the power to turn the traffic lights green, which of course made a very strong impression on my little mind. And we would pull up to the lights, and of course, sometimes he was able to do it instantly, and sometimes he had to do the magic spell a little bit longer. But invariably, he was able to do it. And I remember us in the back seat just, you know, how does he do it? We were so excited. And when my brother figured it out, he had the concern for his little sisters not to tell us until, you know, one by one, we all got through. And it's so typical, you know, we talk about God as the Father and we talk about God as the Mother, and it's not merely sentimental for us to do it. It's metaphysical. There's very profound and true reasons, male and female, positive and negative, all of the dualities that you recognize exist first in spirit, and then that's why the world is created the way it is. I mean, why would there be two genders? Why would there be male bodies? Why would there be female bodies? Because this masculine and feminine is a cosmic reality, and it comes down and we experience it and we embrace it, even to the extent of generating a body that will incline us one way or another. But we also, there's always multi-dimensions to every aspect of spirit. So there's this metaphysical God beyond creation is the masculine, God within creation is the feminine. And then you see in the family, not really anymore, but the father would be the take care of things, more distant. The mother would be the one who gives birth to the children and is more intimate with the children in creation, beyond creation. But the other side of it is very simple, which is we're trying to grasp something that is really not so obvious. And so the world is constructed in such a way that we get to practice. We get to practice in all sorts of ways. And the point of all these experiences is really not what we imagine, that it's an end in itself. Just think of how little children love their teddy bears and love their babies and their dollies, and the way the child will just take care of that baby. And it has to go everywhere with you. And I remember this little boy had a little stuffed something, a stuffed monkey. And it was always everywhere that he was. And when he came up once for a blessing at Sunday service carrying his stuffed monkey, Swami Kriyananda solemnly blessed the child and then solemnly blessed the monkey. Because from the child's point of view, it would have been completely wrong not to have done that. And Swami just went right along. He didn't try to explain, this is an inanimate object. You know, this is the same as your sweater. I'm not blessing your sweater. It's just a thing. Because the child was learning relationships, love, respect, even sharing. If I'm getting blessed, my monkey has to get blessed. And Swamiji honored that on the level on which it was happening. I mean, if I had come up with my stuffed toy, I would have gotten a different response. Because it wouldn't have been helpful to me to allow me to carry on. In fact, I had this children's book. I saw this book in Erica's classroom. And it was about Mary and Jesus. And she showed it to me because the first graders really love it. And it has these beautiful, I think, illustrations. And it's from the point of view of the donkey who carried Mary and Jesus into Jerusalem. It's a famous book, so many of you may know it. When carried them to Bethlehem. And I thought it was so nice. I got it for Narayani, who was the woman who took care of Swamiji. And they were in India, and I took it over to India, and I left a whole bunch of things there. But somehow or another, the fact that book was intended for her got lost in the translation. So I get an email from Swami that says, I know that I'm old, but I haven't yet entered my second childhood. Please be courteous to whoever left this book for me, but, you know, I'm not so impressed. And then he made some reference to the fact that Narayani didn't think much of it either, right? So by now I'm comfortable enough with myself and Swami, so this was no trauma. I said, well, apparently the one who's entered their second childhood is me, because I thought it was a great book, and I brought it over here for Narayani. But he wasn't going to encourage that in me. It didn't help me for him to encourage that in me. And all the way through our many incarnations, we are always in this same relationship to Heavenly Father and to Divine Mother, aren't we? You know, there's the time when you let your child win at the card games, and then there's a time when your child realizes that he's being allowed to let win and he has to begin to compete on a certain level. And so with us, there are incarnations in which Divine Mother just gives us everything we want. There was a story of Master, Swami tells in the Path, about one of Master's disciples there at Mount Washington. And Swami, a Master, would introduce him as my baby. He was a grown man. He said, I call him my baby because I'm babying him. And he said to the disciple, you don't mind, do you? And the little man said, no, sir, I don't mind. But it wasn't a compliment. It was just more, I'm babying him because he's not ready for anything stronger. So I just baby him. And he was enough of a baby not to know he was being babied and to think it was just fine. And so we go through all these different phases of life, don't we? Where God actually just gives us exactly what we're able to take. And nothing more. And then we define God according to how he's treating us. And, you know, God answers all my prayers. God does what I want him to do. God got me this beautiful house, this apartment, this parking place. You know, just step by step by that. And if we define our relationship with God that way, then that's sort of everything that we see. And anything more than that, it doesn't come to us because we're not looking for it. There's an amazing story about Sri Ramakrishna, who was an avatar who lived in the 1800s near Calcutta. And he was born free with this extremely elevated consciousness. And his first experience of transcending the body and going into samadhi, when he was, I believe he was 6 or 7, and he lived out in a village area, and it was the monsoon time and there was dark clouds, and he was walking across a field and he looked up and there were these white birds flying across the sky, and the stark contrast between the white of the birds and the darkness of the clouds reminded him as a child of the amazing duality of God's creation. And looking at the birds, he fell down into samadhi. And they found him unconscious and brought him, you know, back to the village, and he gradually came out of that. Because wherever he looked, he saw perfect evidence of God's complete participation in this world. And yet there are others who are absolutely convinced that there is no divinity, that nothing is divine, and Divine Mother just lets us go on like that. And it's Swami Kriyananda's life was stunningly filled with trials and tribulations from the point of view of some of us. But whenever anyone would speak to him about his life being difficult, it was not a pretense for him to just sort of look a little puzzled. Has it been? And then this one woman who was determined to get Swami to feel sorry for himself, just made a list of all the difficulties he'd had in the last month that she'd known him. Oh, he said, just, it never crossed his mind to think of it like anything like that. In my book about him, I tell the story of him having to fill out a medical form for a new doctor. I believe I was with him and I was reading it off and checking it. By that point in his life, he had heart problems, he had diabetes, he had blood sugar issues, he had 2 hips because of arthritis, he'd had lung problems. So I'm going, yes, yes, yes. And then it says at the bottom, how would you rate your overall health? Swami says, excellent, just excellent. But there was no pretense in that. It was like, How do you rate God's care for me? Excellent, just excellent. Because when we're ready, God really looks at us completely differently. But part of that getting ready is to develop in our own hearts and minds what we would call the attitude of a disciple. That we would think that things are not coming to us to cause us difficulties, to make us miserable, that God will bless us when this happens. When I get this, when I get that, when I get over this illness. But that he's blessing me right now. And that whatever circumstances we're in this moment, how we frame them in our own consciousness depends to a certain extent, to a very large extent, on whether or not we see the divine in them, or we just think, what? What do we think? What we too often think is that we're waiting to be rescued. That's one of the greatest dangers in life, is that we're waiting to be rescued, rather than deal with whatever this is. When Swami Kriyananda made it clear that the likelihood is that my astral ascension ceremony will be in this temple because I'm going to die in this community, not soon, but whenever it's going to happen, I don't get to move somewhere else. My own life, my own image of myself was that I would start many communities instead of doing instead, just developing one. It doesn't really matter to me. It was just the way I thought it would happen. But at a certain point, Swami said, no, I don't think so. I think you're just where you should be, and you're just going to stay there. But it was the oddest thing. The first thing I thought of was a place in the garden where nothing would grow, a closet that I was going to actually have to clean out. You know, just a certain people that I thought I could just move away from and never have to learn to get along with. You know, that we just wouldn't finish the karma, we would just run away from it. And it was embarrassing to me, I think. Appalling, actually, is probably a better word. When that phrase, oh, I'm just waiting to be rescued from these things. But really, think about it for a minute. How can we ever be rescued from anything? Because wherever we go, we're there, aren't we? It has been my habit in life, somewhat, not as much lately, unfortunately, to take seclusion every year or two. And I've never been good at seclusion is a time where you go someplace where you can live comfortably. You don't talk to anyone. You don't communicate with anyone. You just have time for meditation and silence. It's a wonderful practice. But I've never been good. People can take seclusion for a weekend. I can't, because Asha hangs around for about 3 or 4 days. And just when she's just beginning to die off, if I have to come back, I never get the benefit of it. I have to really give myself enough time to just get rid of her. But then there's all this other reality that is always in there. We're just always having our preferences, and we have this imagination. I would feel God more if I just, my body felt better, I didn't have these headaches, my blood sugar were more stable, I didn't have this weight problem, I didn't have this awful person who was upset with me. I've been in circumstances with Swamiji where, I know what I was remembering. In the path, there's this story Swami tells about this man who was in charge of, I believe it was the lake shrine at that time. He didn't stay with Master as a disciple. He left the ashram. But he liked to be important. And Master came for a certain event at the lake shrine. And because this man was in charge, he was going to show Master that he was really in charge. And Swami Kriyananda was a young monk, and he'd come along with Master. I believe it was a concert or something like that. And so this monk thought the way to show that he was in charge was to boss Kriyananda around all the time. Would you please get a blanket for Master? I believe Master needs a glass of water. Would you be kind enough to bring it? This is not the right chair. Could you bring that one from over there? And Swamiji, he didn't care at all. But Master, seeing how this man was acting, began to boss Swami around too. You know, yes, I believe I need that. Could you get this for me? And Swamiji said something interesting about Master. He said, you would imagine that Master would contradict people. That's sort of how we think. Someone speaks wrongly, we correct them. That's our thought. But people don't usually learn that way. Master would often push you in the direction of the delusion where you were already going. And sometimes he would reflect back to you the very attitude that you were showing so you could see it in the mirror. So here's the case. This monk is being high-handed. He's being bossy. He thinks that's the way to be. So Master starts being high-handed and bossy. I mean, because sometimes you don't realize it, or you don't realize what it looks like. And if you suddenly see your own guru behaving in a way that's so uncharacteristic of him, it does work. But Swamiji said, the more Master bossed him around, the more this other monk bossed him around, he said, just the happier and happier he felt. And there was this look in Master's eye just between them. There was just this sweetness. The more of a bully Master was being toward him, the more this sweetness was going between them. Because you see, Swami understood that behind it, there was the hand of God blessing him. Now, when is that not true? When in your life is the hand of God not blessing you? When in your life is your guru not actually ordering your life perfectly? It's a wonderful thought to meditate on. I've shared with you many times at a particular crisis point in my life when I was feeling particularly deeply stressed about suffering that was going on around me. I was just distraught over it, and this voice in my mind said, do you think this is happening outside the will of God? And it was very funny. Sometimes we don't like our own spiritual path, because I was very annoyed when I had that thought, because I was very committed to being upset. We do get committed to being upset. Women have this phrase, I need to have a good cry. You know, just like that's thing sort of comes over you, and if I can just cry for a while, then I'll feel fine again. And so there's a pleasure in it, a perverse kind of pleasure, and just collapsing into the emotions and not trying to be brave anymore. And it's exhausting, and it distracts you from solving the problem. There's a whole lot of other things why it's good. Then you feel like you've actually done something, even though nothing has changed. But I was in that energy, but then this thought came through my mind, and it just essentially stopped me in my tracks. If this is happening by the will of God, why am I behaving like this? And it wasn't that I could immediately control it, although in that case it was easier than it sometimes is. Sometimes the vrittis in the spine have just got you, and they're just whirling, and you can still know it's by the will of God, but it doesn't make any difference. But how can it be happening outside the will of God, and then why would I not embrace it? That's Jesus' very simple advice. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to them the left also. He wasn't countenancing cowardice or even necessarily pacifism. He was talking about if something comes at you that you think is not what you want, what is the normal thing that we do? We hunker down and we hope that it'll go away. But if we ask ourselves, is this, like everything else, a gift from God? And so instead of stepping back from it, we step forward. And someone's striking us on one side and we ask to be hit on the other. Not because we want to be hit, but why would we wait to be rescued? Why would we run away? If God is giving us an opportunity to face something, why would we not want it? Oh, I have lots of reasons, you know. I remember Swamiji wanted me to take on a project. He said, why aren't you doing this? Are you lazy? Are you afraid? Are you too busy? Are you just, do you have lack of concentration? All of the above, sir. All of them. Yes, every one of them. They're all the reason why I'm not doing it. I mean, why lie? You know, it's just, there's a certain, well, tamasic energy is what it's called. Tamasic energy is downward pulling energy, the energy that says, instead of meditating, I'll just see what's on television tonight. And there's a certain pleasure in it. And that's the battle we're fighting all the time. The external form of the battle is often quite irrelevant. That's why we want to be rescued, because it's too much effort to solve the problem ourselves. And this is why the spiritual path is 90% about energy, and why it's so important in every circumstance. Sometimes, you know, we can reduce this down to so many simple points. Actually, I'm doing right now a series of seminars based on Swami Kriyananda's 26 Keys to Higher Awareness, which is just a little pamphlet he wrote some years ago. And the first premise of all of that is meet life's experiences with energy. I mean, then it's nice to meet them with calm energy. Then it's nice to meet them with happy energy. But at the very least, meet them with energy. That very thought of just trying to shrink back and hope that the wave will just go over us. You know, isn't that right? I've never been much of a body surfer because I just can't quite figure out how the waves work. But there's always that moment when you're going to try to decide whether you're going to ride the wave or just go under it. Sometimes going under it is worse if you don't get the timing right because you just get completely scrambled up. But there's always that thought, do I have the energy to face this? No, I'm just going to go down. Do I have the energy? No, I'm just going to go down. But sooner or later, one way or another, God is really not hiding anything from us. It's all always right in front of us. I was standing at Deva Prayag on the way to Badrinath in India. And it's this place where two gigantic rivers come together. I can't remember what the names of the rivers are, but it doesn't matter. And you walk down into this canyon, and it's a sacred spot, and the Indians demand access to it. It's not like America, where you'd probably be 28 feet away behind a huge chain-link fence. You actually get to walk right down to where the two rivers converge, and you stand on this little promontory, this little cement thing, and there's a couple of steps down, and just casually there are these big iron chains that you can hold on to, and then you just hold on to the iron chain and you step down, because it's very holy to bathe in the water there. And the steps are a little bit wide, so you only in water up to your ankles. But just listening to Helen talk about God acting in all these different ways, it was like power, one of the eight manifestations of God, power. And I tend to think of that manifestation more as energy and more like my energy, the energy I can put out. But power is also one of it. And we hide from that because we want to feel not afraid. And it was a very interesting paradox to stand where those two rivers came together. On one hand, this is a holy spot, and it's been a holy spot since the two rivers came together, India being what it is. And you could feel it, and you could feel why it was holy. Because here is God manifested as power. And we are so tiny, just so tiny, all of our, you know, we were on this pilgrimage, there were 30 of us, we all had been packing and planning, we had our perfect shoes and our little outfits and our perfect carry-on luggage, and just, you know, everything was just so, and the river was, it just couldn't have cared less, I don't know how else to say it, everything that mattered to us, and there was this strange, hardly suicidal, but this strange inclination to just step into the water. And you knew if you stepped into that water, you were over. I mean, not hold on to the chain and dip, but I mean just go into the river. And it was an interesting reality also in this respect. I knew that that would be the end of my physical body. And on a certain level, I didn't care, but I was conscious of the fact there would be a lot of trouble behind me if I did that. You know, it would interrupt the pilgrimage for all those other people. A lot of things would happen that weren't good. And I didn't do it. But I thought of the river of spirit that runs within us, of the kundalini energy that's always calling to us, of the power of God that's in front of us, and what it means to step into that. Because everything in this world is just a symbol. If that river looked powerful to me, if the power of God's ability to obliterate everything I call myself was you know, a hair's width away from me, just moving in a split second. Imagine what it is to just be gone. Swami Kriyananda has mentioned, and he can mention it from his experience because it's nothing that I would know otherwise. He talks about at the moment of final freedom, when you are merging into that light, he said, there is a moment of intense loneliness when you realize that there is only one reality, and oddly, that you are entirely alone, that all of this reaching out, trying to get satisfaction from all these other external places, he's described it as that final delusion is completely gone, and you realize that all you are and have ever been is that one reality. And all this reaching and striving and trying and trying to fill ourselves from the outside, long we've feared to face thy love, lest our emptiness it prove. That's what we sing every week. He said, in that moment, he said, there's this moment of intense loneliness. And then he said, instantly though, it's replaced by bliss. When you realize that that solitary reality is nothing but the joy we have always been seeking. Isn't that an extraordinary thought? God bless you.